Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am George Hammond, a member of the club's Humanities Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Carol Fleming. Dr. Fleming is a Bay Area speaking coach and author. Her publications include The Sound of Your Voice and It's the Way That You Say It. She has taught in a number of local universities, designed communication skill programs for businesses and organizations, and maintains a private practice across the street from the Commonwealth Club. She is also on the board of directors of the Commonwealth Club. Today, as you are aware, is Abraham Lincoln's 200th birthday, and Dr. Fleming is going to speak about the Gettysburg Address. This address by Abraham Lincoln was at the consecration of a graveyard in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania in 1863. It is a much beloved document. It is certainly well known. It's an example of elegant writing, and it is very, very short. All told, a perfect document to help us examine the characteristics of eloquence. In addition, on this 200th birthday, current political circumstances, of which you're all familiar, make this reacquaintance with Lincoln even more poignant. We all have the voices and rhetoric of presidential candidates ringing in our ears. Did you notice any differences? What a good time to consider the elements of powerful and eloquent rhetoric. Therefore, it is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this today. Dr. Carol Fleming.
Fourscore and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It's altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here. It will never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, and by the people, and for the people, shall not perish from the earth. 9 sentences, 272 words from a self-taught prairie politician. These words were spoken at the consecration of a graveyard in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, commemorating the greatest battle of the Civil War, which was the greatest man-made disaster in American history. The Gettysburg Address has a singular and mythic place in the consciousness of any American. At the same time, it's an enduring example of eloquent rhetoric. And that's where I come in. Eloquence, not a word you hear all the time, unfortunately. But let's take a look at what we mean by eloquence. It is vivid, fluent, and graceful language. And in this morning's paper, I found a wonderful example of it. I think this lady right here was also reading it here. I'm going to read you a sentence written by Robert Ingersoll 100 years ago, talking about Abraham Lincoln. Listen to this sentence. Lincoln was a many-sided man, acquainted with smiles and tears, complex in brain, single in heart, direct as light, and his words, candid as mirrors, gave the perfect image of his thoughts. What better example could we use for vivid, fluent, graceful language? Now, as for this word, rhetoric is language to move people to a specific action. With your language, you make them feel something and do something. It is the tool of democracy. Without rhetoric, we have no democracy because we do things with words, not with orders, not with bullets, not with tradition, but we talk. Oh, how we talk. We argue. We make speeches. We debate. We mediate. Words, words, this is what rhetoric is all about. It is essential for democracy. It's essential for leadership. As I know, there are people here with leadership positions that have to manage very difficult situations. You have layoffs. You have mergers. You have changes that require somebody at the helm to turn and address the people in such a way that they can come together as one, that they stay on the same page, they can keep moving the agenda. And that is the function of a leader, to have skilled rhetoric. Now, when people come to me as a speech coach, they don't ask to be eloquent rhetoricians. I have never had anybody ask for help there. I wish they did. That would be delightful. They usually want to they want to be clear, and they want to be informative. Being clear and informative are fine goals. I am not putting them down, but they're a far cry from eloquence and leadership. Clear and informative is pretty much the language of science, and it serves science well. If you want to make either a bomb or a bundt cake, you want to have it right. But when you want to move people, when you want to stir them, then we look at eloquence, and then we look at rhetoric. I got fascinated with the Gettysburg Address some time ago because I looked at this little gem of a speech, and I wondered, why is this so good? Why do we love it so? Why is it enduring? What is it about the Gettysburg Address that makes all of you love it too? So I asked questions like, why is it important? Again, why is it good? And most of all, what can we learn from the Gettysburg Address that helps us develop more eloquent speech, more effective rhetoric? And that's what I'm going to talk about today. The Gettysburg Address, as any speech, exists in a historical context. There was a time and a place that it was uttered, and it's the context that gives it meaning. So I must share with you some historical notes, not as much as I would like, but enough, I hope. July 1863 was a crucial month in the history of this country, crucial for Abraham Lincoln. The battle at Gettysburg was a great victory, the first great victory. And it was announced, it happened on the 4th of July, as did the victory in Vicksburg. Abraham Lincoln was very aware of the singular meaning of the 4th of July. Adams and Jefferson died on the 4th of July. And of course, we have the signing of the Declaration of Independence, which to you and me means fireworks and picnics, but it meant a lot more to Abraham Lincoln. Let me read something that he wrote in July of 1863 after Gettysburg and Vicksburg. For the first time in the history of the world, a nation declared as a self-evident truth that all men are created equal. Let's put that in the back of our mind, of where Abraham Lincoln is in his thinking about the importance of the Declaration of Independence. For the first time in the history of the world, we've declared as a nation, as a self-evident truth, that all men are created equal. That's pretty big stuff. He believed that the Civil War would either save or destroy America, and with it, constitutional democracy. I'm seeing a much larger vision here, much bigger issues than I think we typically think about with Abraham Lincoln. So why did he write the Gettysburg Address? Words cannot capture the horror of the Civil War, the squandering of American blood, the ferocity of the fighting. We'd have to wax operatic to induce in you what this country was going through with this battle. There were horrendous casualties. In Gettysburg alone, three days, over 50,000 people died in a very small town of 2,400 people. And the end was not in sight. People were getting tired. They were weary. They were losing any idea of what are we about? Why are we doing this? What's going on? And they had lost a sense of purpose. Lincoln knew that it was up to him to find a way to heal people, to unite them, in order to sustain the military effort to finish the war, in order to protect the Union. He's a war president. He's got to keep them fighting. He's got to keep them together, keep them fighting, if we're going to keep this Union together. Because he would not give up one inch of the United States of America to secessionists, not on his watch. That he thought was his mandate. This is what he is all about. So why is this speech so important to us? Now, you look at this speech and what did he achieve with it? I think what we can say is he managed to put the core meaning of what it means to be an American down on paper. He defined us for us. Oh, that's who we are. We are one people dedicated to a proposition. That's who we are. And he translated this meaning into words and ideas that were accessible to every American. He used universal terms to allow a broad patriotic coalition. So important. This is why, as you listen to that address today, he didn't talk about the North and South. He didn't talk about Meade or Lee. He didn't talk about any particular thing that could be divisive. He spoke to what could unite us on the highest possible grounds. He had an artist's ear for the sound and rhythm of sentences that create emotion. And he used language that could be memorized and recited by students forever. Students like maybe people in this room, students just like you. How many of you could recite the Gettysburg Address? Oh, there's one over there. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 out of a full house. Okay, but watch this. How many of you know at least part of it? That's much bigger response there. You probably know the opening and the closing, right? Of course you do. And for a good reason. But we will get into that. Now, why is it so darn good? What is it about it that I just makes me feel so positive about it? And you do too. So as a speaking coach, I'm going to look at it in the terms that I know to look at a speech, and we're going to examine its organization and its words. Those are the tools we have to work with. And we are going to add two secret ingredients to powerful public speaking. And I'm going to tell you one of those secrets right now. Passion. Persuasion is powerfully served by passion. And your personal tone of conviction is the most powerful element in inspiring others. Your vocal dynamics is what takes any message from heart to heart. And without that, it is flat words on the paper. Now, what happens is most of you write talks, and then you read those speeches, but you've short-circuited the whole human cycle of getting it into your mind and into your body and letting your body express your attitudes about it. So you flatten the vocal dynamic and lose one of your most powerful tools of persuasion. Can you do something about this? Yes, you can. I won't talk about that now, but perhaps in the Q&A, if you have questions about vocal dynamics, I'll be happy to talk about it at that time. I want to get into organization of this speech. Now, when I started this, I had no idea about the power of organization in a speech. What I have learned from Abraham Lincoln, I'm going to share with you tonight, is astonishing. Now, you know that you need to put language in a certain order for it to have meaning. You know words have meaning. Words together depends on how they are in a sequence. Man bites dog is different from dog bites man. The syntax of a sentence matters. Well, the syntax of a whole paragraph or a speech matter equally in transmitting meaning. I'm going to talk about five architectural features of the Gettysburg Address now, five, which give structure to these words and answer for me the question of why does this go down so easily? Why is it so smooth? So let's get started with the very first one. One you probably know, many of you, is to have an initial summarizing statement. You start off with a statement of what you're all about. Our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. That is a summarizing statement that tells it like it is. Now, that statement is the single most powerful sentence ever spoken in American history. There are more assumptions underlying it, books written about it, arguments made about it, none of which I can develop right now, but just know, if you have any available time, look into that opening statement and you will find practically the history of the world. Now, what's Lincoln just put it out there. He said, this is the way it is. It commands assent because I say so. It defies contradiction. There it is. Did you ever hear the one about the three baseball umpires? Of course, they go to heaven, and they're being screened by St. Peter at the gate, who asks them, how do you make a call on a pitched ball? And the first umpire says, I calls them as I sees them. And, of course, the second umpire approaches St. Peter, who repeats the question, and this umpire replies, I calls them as they are. Oh, but the third umpire, you're waiting for that, aren't you? The third umpire says, they ain't nothing till I calls them. Think about that. So we have chaos, contradiction, confusion. Lincoln called it. He says, this is who you are. This is what you're about. And by golly, we are. But only because he said so. We have become so inured to these words. I mean, they're apple pie to us, aren't they? We learned them in elementary school. We don't really come to grips with the fact that he just defined us. I'm trying to rattle that cage a little bit. So before Gettysburg, people said the United States are da-da-da-da. After Gettysburg, the United States is. Okay? No Lincoln, no nation. Now, let's go on to the next structural element. And here is something very familiar to all of you, a tripartite form of a speech, a beginning and a middle and an end. Okay, you've all heard that. You've all heard, tell them what, I guess from the Army, tell them what you're going to tell them what you told them. The mind likes three parts, introduction, body, conclusion. All right. Well, Lincoln had his version of the three parts, too. The past, 67 years ago, he sets the basis with the historical past to the present, and this past leads right to the present. Now we are engaged in a great civil war. We are met on a great battle. We have all this present tense words where he takes a whole bunch of time saying, here's where we are. Here's what's happening now. Leading to the future. It is for us, the living, to be dedicated to the great task remaining before us. The past is leading right up to the present and explains it. The present is used to drive the future. They are knit together to form a structural element in this speech and a piece of its meaning. Now, the next three structural elements are not elements that you've ever been taught. They are the mark of genius. Here's Abraham Lincoln now, not an ordinary man. He was the most skilled literary craftsman to ever entered the White House. And I want to show you three things that he did in this little speech, which I find just astonishing in their eloquence and they have to do with organization. Okay. This first one I called focusing. It's on the first part of the Gettysburg Address. He is going to move you through space in such a way that he has great depth to the meaning of the speech. So stick with me now. On this continent, a new nation, now engaged in a great civil war, we are met on a great battlefield of that war, come for a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives, that that nation might live. Look what he did. Look how he just turned the dial on that microscope. Starting with a continent, nation, war, battlefield, portion, final resting place. Brought you in right, looking down into that hole in the ground and says, what's the meaning of that hole in the ground? The meaning of that hole is that that nation might live. That's the meaning of death. Let's go on to the next one. And the next one has to do with his use of the word dedicate. He uses it 6 times in this speech. In the beginning, a nation is dedicated to a proposition. Okay, and he uses it, the word dedicate, twice. So that's the first use of dedicate. The nation is dedicated to a proposition, he says. Okay. Let's go down to the middle of the speech. We are now dedicating a graveyard. He's taken that word up here and put it right down in the middle. We're going to dedicate a graveyard. Now Lincoln does a fast U-turn. I mean, he was invited there to dedicate. Okay, I'm here dedicating. But we cannot dedicate, he says. What? We come to dedicate? We cannot dedicate? What's going on? What should we be doing? It is for us, the living, to be dedicated. We are to be dedicated. To what? To the past? To the completion of the Civil War? To the future? To re-engagement with this great proposition that gives us meaning? So, dedicated to a proposition, dedicate a graveyard, dedicated to the future of America. One word did an awful lot of work in that speech. It's pretty fancy footwork, wouldn't you say? Okay, now the last structural element, I'm talking about how you organize a speech. The last structural element here that I want to talk about is sheer brilliance. The whole of the speech, from beginning to end, is a religious metaphor, starting with birth. Our fathers brought forth a new nation conceived and dedicated. What is that? That's birth, right? In the middle, we are met on, we've come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives. Death. Further on, we shall have a new birth of freedom. Oh, born again. Okay. And at the end, government of the people shall not perish. Immortality. Birth, death, rebirth, immortality. This nation is a baby. And part of the great Christian structure. I want to say, of course, that metaphor is used in other religions too, but I thought that was brilliant. Because what do these people in his audience, what do they have at home? The King James Bible. What do they do with that Bible? They read it. They talk about it. They go to prayer meetings. Lincoln's mother was a person who memorized a lot from the Bible. So he's using and that's structure now, using a structural element that speaks right to the bones of these people. And I never thought I would say that his organization of the speech was the most powerful feature of the Gettysburg Address. I never thought I'd ever say such words, but there it is. Let's go on to the words now. The aspect I want to talk about first is he used words to unite. Let me show you how. He started with the verbal handshake. The verbal handshake is the beginning of most speeches where the speaker tries to develop a relationship with the audience in some way. Someone might speak here at the Commonwealth Club and say, "Oh, I've so enjoyed listening to the programs of the Commonwealth Club. You have such good speakers." Da, 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 da. So he's establishing that I am one of you. I know about you. And they also show humility. So I'm so honored to be here. Because to stand up, I'm standing, you're sitting, I'm talking, you're listening, is to have a leadership position, which makes me superior, which is kind of dangerous. So I want to level this playing field so I don't feel like I'm lording it over you. So I'm going to try to humble myself. What does a president do to open a speech? Ever since FDR, my fellow Americans. My fellow Americans. Okay. What did Mr. Obama say? My fellow citizens. He's the first one to introduce a variation on that. Why? Because his inauguration was about citizenship. So he put his new little wrinkle in. What did Lincoln do? None of the above. But what I think he did to establish a group feeling is found in his choice of words. When he said, 87 years ago, our fathers, your dad, my dad? Well, gosh, if he's talking about what our fathers did, what does that make us? Well, we're kind of a cohort, aren't we? We're a generation. We're brothers and sisters here. Just by saying our fathers, I think he created a group feeling. And by the way, this is what he had to say about immigrants in America. Let me quote here. And the American birthright. They have a right to claim it as though they were blood of the blood and flesh of the flesh of the men who wrote that declaration, and so they are. No. Our fathers included everybody. Let's take a look at his use of the words us, we, and our. Now, he used that 15 times. He used us, we, and our. That's 5.5% of his total of 272 words. And he never used I or you. Don't you think that builds a kind of a group feeling if you just use these pronouns that declare that we are a group? So I think that was his verbal handshake. Lincoln used biblical and emotional resonances, but he didn't do it in such a way that would offend the many secular people in his audiences. But listen to some of these words that he used, because I think that he chose those because they have added resonance, added meaning to his address. First of all, what's this with 87 years? Why 87 years? This man knew how to say 87. He did all the time. You read in his writings, he knew how to say 1776. Real good, too. What's with 87? Well, why do you suppose he chose that as a beginning? I mean, it is a very interesting opening, isn't it? It's not a conventional opening. But doesn't it remind you of something like Psalm 90? The days of our years are 70. Which everybody in that audience knew. 70 years and 10. Well, 70 and 7 is going to start making you think about those prayer meetings at home, isn't it? What's the next two words out of his mouth? Our Father. Well, what's the prayer that's even said that very day during the 3-hour ceremony? Our Father who art in heaven. Certainly a stable in every home. Brought forth. That's a biblical term for birth. Jesus was brought forth from Mary. It also describes the Israelites being brought forth from slavery. And I'll just jump to the end now. I'm going way out on a limb, but try this one. If I say, government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth, I wonder if that doesn't have a little ring of, for thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Just a thought. But we seldom talk about using and selecting words that are rich in dimension and emotional content because we've become so scientific and clean in our word choices, which has its place, has a purpose. But if you want eloquence, you're going to search for that word that has many dimensions to it that can resonate with people and speak to them on a subliminal level. I might point out that he uses these wonderful triple rhythms that people love. You hear, certainly in Obama, Martin Luther King was a master of that. But in the Gettysburg Address, we have, we are engaged, we are met, we have come. We cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow. That from these honored dead, that we here highly resolve, that this nation under God. See that rhythm building up here? This is why I spoke the Gettysburg Address at the beginning tonight. Because I suspect that most of you have read it. It's part of your visual system. And if you just have it up in your eyes, you're not going to respond to these rhythmic aspects to it. You need to hear it, which is why when you prepare your speeches, read it out loud. See how it sounds. What is clunky? Where can you introduce some of the poetry and the rhythms that engage the ear? Lincoln wrote for the ear, which is what is so different from people writing speeches nowadays who sit down at a keyboard, engage their fingers, and call that writing a speech. Lincoln would not recognize this as writing a speech. I'm going to not talk about delivery right now, but if someone has questions about that, perhaps in the Q&A we can talk, because there's some things that I would love to talk about that I want to be sure we have proper time for. I want to get to that second secret ingredient on skillful public speaking. And that secret is do something. Put some energy into developing yourself as a speaker. It will not come to you on wings in the night. You have to work for it intentionally. You have to listen to speakers intentionally. Asking yourself, why is this person good? What do I like about that? What's boring about that? How do I want to change myself to be? So listen with more intention to a speaker to find out what you like. Join a group. Join Toastmasters. Join National Speakers Association. Any place where Public speaking is encouraged and practiced, and you're with your fellows who can encourage you. Just do something. Take every opportunity that you can in your life to stand up and speak. In your house of worship, in your organizations, give the business report. I don't care. But get used to standing up, looking at people in the eye, and talking to them. Because the more you don't do that, the more you allow stage fright to develop, so it becomes kind of a scary thing. But if you keep getting up on your feet and talking to people, you're more likely to stay comfortable. Give your speech writing more respect and time. This is where we let ourselves down, is that we don't take it seriously. And develop it and refine it. Lincoln had enough brains to make a difference. He had enough heart to want to do it. And he had the willingness to work at it. That's what made him so different from the rest of us. Now, he never spoke off the cuff. He composed all of his own speeches. He was a very slow and careful writer who crafted and polished his briefs and remarks. He agonized. He nitpicked. He amended. He tore up and started over. He participated in literary and debating societies. He rehearsed with live audiences. He sought out criticism, and he just wordsmithed to the very end. He had that tall stovepipe hat he used to wear as a country lawyer, filled with notes. He'd think about something, he'd get a piece of paper, scribble it down, put it in his hat, put his hat on his head. Now, because he did all of these things, he was able to transform the ugly reality of Gettysburg into the very symbol of national purpose and pride and ideals. But I think that, moreover, he was actually talking about liberal democracy. He had said that the United States of America was the last best hope of the world. And in the very Gettysburg Address itself, I think we have evidence that he has this worldview. He did say, Civil War, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and dedicated. That's bigger than us. Any nation. He said, the world will little note nor long remember. Okay? And he said, that government of the people, not this government, not our government, not America, but government of the people. I'm hearing a broader view with this man. I think his first mandate was the protection of liberal democracy, which we had going here, that we were the first to have it, and that if it can't happen here, where is it going to happen? And I think that is why he's going to, by God, not let this go down. He's fighting for the world. Freedom for the world, and not just America. My thought. Well, Lincoln's words continue to inspire us today, and his language still carries power across time and around the world. And let me finish with a quote from just 50 years ago. As the Soviet tanks were crushing the Hungarian Revolution of 1956, the final message of the Hungarian freedom fighters, broadcast on the Free Hungarian Radio, was a reading of the Gettysburg Address. Well, the world will little note nor long remember what I say here, but you might. Thank you.
But we can handle the questions in one of two ways. If anybody has written on their card a question, we can collect it. But if you'd like to ask a question directly to Carol, as you can see, it was a great combination of both talk about Abraham Lincoln and his Gettysburg Address and also about the actual elements of speech writing, speech making. So both elements of that approach can be asked questions.
Hi. I was just wondering if you could expand a little bit more about delivery.
Sure.
That you had said.
Okay. The young lady was asking about delivery, which is, of course, projecting your voice out to a group. Now, understand, when Abraham Lincoln spoke, he had at least 10,000 people in front of him, probably much more. They did not have electricity. He did not have a microphone. They did not have speakers. Amplifiers were first used in 1919 when Woodrow Wilson spoke down in Los Angeles, and I believe it was a Magnavox. So he and you, when you need to speak out to people, I would give you two things that I think are the most important things to remember about delivery. And the first one is you must keep your face and your upper chest up and out so that your voice can be projected out into the room. This is your sounding mechanism. You need to put it out. What are the hazards of this? Well, when you read, you put your head down like this and talk right into the paper. Of course, that's not going to go out, is it? It's going to go right down. The second hazard is when you have a PowerPoint. You've got your back to the audience. Okay, and of course, that just breaks the whole relationship with people. So that's the first piece of, I think, really important knowledge you need to have about delivery. Now, the second one will be new to you, I think. And that has to do with the enhancement of your vowels as carriers of speech. Consonants are noise elements. They're brief, they're wide spectrum, they come out of your mouth and just fall down. They don't go anywhere. What travels is the resonance in a vowel. And I would have you examine the vowel structure of your remarks so that you can bring those out, because those will, in fact, travel. Now, let me ask you, if I said the word Washington, what are the vowel sounds in Washington? Want to guess?
A-I-O.
A-I-O. How many agree with A-I-O? Okay, all right, about a third of you. How many, somebody have a different version? A different answer? Loudly. Washington. Are the vowels. And everybody does go by their visual system and name letters. Those are not vowels. They're just labels for letters. Vowel is the actual sound. And we're not connected really well with our vowel structure. I'd have you go through a phrase and say it out loud, figure out what is the proper vowel there, and then give it more energy, because that will carry it out. Now, where the vowels go, the consonants go too. So that learn to pay attention to vowels, not letters, vowels, and you'll have a much better projection.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on why PowerPoint is problematic? Because this is going against the current trends.
I know.
Or maybe does it have any uses?
Oh, it does. Yeah. In information. It has really good use in when you need visual information displayed, especially of a graphic nature, that you need to share with a group. But there's a lot to know about skillful use of PowerPoint so that it supplements you as a speaker and does not dominate you. We see the reverse so often that many of you think that that's the way it should be used. I would have the minimum use of slides, very few word slides, mostly visual graphics, so that your attention is always on the people you're communicating with, and any slide is simply something that supplements what you have to say, and you turn it off when you don't need it. I have a lot more to say about PowerPoint, but I don't know whether we want to go into all that detail now. So yes, there's a place for it, used skillfully.
Questions?
First, thank you very much. That's a beautiful dissection of the speech. But my question is it true that the speech didn't gain the celebrity that we know of at this point until about 1890 or so, when Lincoln's secretary, then John Hay, was one of them, started writing about the speech and told people why it was such a great speech?
Well, what you say is there's a lot of truth in what you say, but there is so much myth and misinformation about Lincoln, for starters, and then the Gettysburg Address. If you read any account of the speech itself, you can find so many differences in how they describe it. Some people say it was dead silence. People didn't like it. Other people say he was interrupted five times with applause. So you have to read a lot of books to try to get a sense of it. I think he knew, if I know Lincoln, when he spoke it during that day, there were certain people who were going to hear it, and that would have a certain effect. I think what he was counting on was that it was going to be published so it could have wider dissemination. So I think he felt that it was the written form that was going to carry the message out to the country rather than his spoken form. As for how many years that took for it to become iconic, I'm not sure. But I know at that time, Abraham Lincoln was not yet Abraham Lincoln. Okay, even to speak at the ceremony apparently was problematic for a number of people on the cemetery commission who felt that this gawky hick would not have sufficient polish at this wonderful event, and that he may well use the opportunity to do a political speech, because we got elections coming up in just a couple years, and they didn't trust him that he wouldn't do a political speech. And the feeling is that in the note that they sent him was the words that he should come and do a few appropriate remarks. And it is probable that Lincoln knew that this was directive language, telling him, stick the point and keep it short, bud. Okay. Which may be why the Gettysburg Address is as short as it is. So he did not have the stature then that he has now. But again, you hear different accounts.
I'll read one from the audience. Where do you think Lincoln and Obama learned their style of eloquence?
Well, I know where Obama learned it. I don't know the answer to Lincoln. I will hazard a guess, because remember, this guy is self-taught. So he wasn't learning it from anybody. He was having to pick it up as best he could. Now, he was a voracious reader. He read Shakespeare. How many people do you know with less than 1 year of school who loves to read Shakespeare out loud to people? He was immersing himself in the richest language known to man. So he clearly had an ear for the beauty of language. If I've learned anything from my reading, is that Lincoln was canny and savvy and shrewd. He loved language. He knew how to use it. There's a book called Lincoln's Sword. Well, guess what his sword is? His rhetoric. That is how he fought this war. He won the war where bullets never could. So self-taught. Well, he has so many models that he can follow. Well, you know, we haven't talked about, and we cannot talk about Martin Luther King, to if you want to see rhetorical devices done to a fare thee well, Martin Luther King practically sings his speeches. And that's another whole talk of how he uses all of these rhetorical devices of alliteration and rhyming and triplets and contrasts. And in his tonalities. Listen to his vowels. He is practically singing when he speaks, and that's because he's energizing his whole stream of vowels. That's why you hear his speech so clearly.
We were taught in school that Lincoln wrote the Gettysburg Address in the back of an envelope on the train to Gettysburg. Could you address that, please?
Oh, yes, that is one of the myths. First of all, I'm going to say, do you believe that? Because I got a bridge. I got a bridge. I mean, to know anything about Lincoln is to know he would never, ever do that. He was such a nitpicker about language, constantly revising and getting it just the way he wanted it. He was not sloppy. Now, it could be that he amended his speech. He could have gone on that whole train ride saying, our founders, our fathers, on upon, changing a word. There's a book written on just all the emendations that he makes on any particular thing that he writes, so you can see how his thinking changed as he worked his way through to the final product of what he wanted. So I have no doubt that somebody saw him write something on a piece of paper, but I don't think he started with fourscore and ended with perish from the earth. I really don't.
Hi. Thank you for giving this presentation to us today. Just about 5 years ago, my father and I, a retired editor at the San Francisco Chronicle, and I went to the National Mall in Gettysburg, and I was not nearly as moved as I am tonight, but my question is, do you think that Lincoln is this nation's best commander-in-chief? Do you think there's ever been a better commander-in-chief than Lincoln?
Oh, my. And he wants my opinion. I'm a speech teacher. What do I know? But I'm still going to answer it anyway. Yes. Yes, for the reasons I think I have already said. If you get this vision that I have gotten from my studies, that we were the test case of liberal democracy. It happened with us, and Lincoln is aware of this fantastic experiment of a bunch of people getting together and say, hey, let's be a nation, let's play house, let's play nation. And the one thing that's going to keep us together, we're dedicated to a proposition that all men are created equal. This is outrageous. No other country has done that. And here comes America, and we're, by God, trying to make it work. You know? And this war is just about to ruin everything. I mean, this is a mess. And to have someone able to step into that breach and save it. Because remember, he had to do the healing, the uniting, and the leading forward. An army can't do that. An army destroys. An army kills. Okay, that does not build a nation. That doesn't heal any sense of loss. Only Lincoln's words could do that. And he was the right man at the right time. And you notice he hasn't fallen out of our hearts yet, and it's been 200 years. He's got something going for him.
How much do we know about what his voice sounded like, for that matter, anyone else before recordings that gave great speeches, and how much does that matter?
Well, let me read you a description of his voice. I have had people come up to me and say, well, Dr. Fleming, would you just play a tape of his voice so we could hear it? Sure. Okay, see if I have it here. Okay, listen to this. Lincoln read in a slow, clear way to the farthest listener. Okay. Quote, this is from Abram Bergen. But whenever he began to talk, his eyes flashed, and every facial movement helped express his idea and feeling. Then, involuntarily vanished all thought or consciousness of his uncouth appearance or awkward manner or even his high-keyed, unpleasant voice. Not Father Abraham. Yes, he is always described as having a high, even shrill, voice. Now, there's something to be said for that. The higher the voice, the more it carries. If you force your voice down low, this is not a voice that's going to go very far. It's going to be very... That's why if you go into a restaurant, you just hear the women's voices up here, and you complain about it. That's just because they're superior communication devices.
We were all wondering that.
One more question?
No. Oh, I just want to tell you that I'm enjoying your lecture very, very much. And I have a question for you. Out of all your seasoning and experience, what is the tradition that you seek to perpetuate with your dedication?
A tradition I seek to perpetuate. Let me say it this way. When I do, in fact, work with people, they come in with goals like, I want to be okay. Okay. I just don't want to make a fool of myself. I want to get through this experience. And that's kind of sad, isn't it? I said, would you consider going for great? How does that sound? Why don't you just be the best speaker at that conference? How about that? Why don't you be a star? You want to be a star? Because it's awful fun to make a star. It's awful fun. And the eyes start sparkle as a person says, you mean I could? Well, it starts with knowing it's possible. It starts with wanting it. And then it leads to willingness to do the work to get it. So that would be the tradition of saying there is such a thing as eloquence. And you can work for it. You can do it. But people have not voiced that near enough to keep me happy.
Yeah, I'm hearing you say you're interested in helping people actualize themselves.
Well, the best, their highest goals.
Right.
Yes. Yes, sir.
I think Dr. Fleming's being modest. I think her tradition is Demosthenes.
Her tradition is what?
Demosthenes.
Who really worked at it. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Fleming.
Thank you.
And we're very happy to have had our first Humanities MLF lecture on a 200th anniversary of Lincoln's birth. We hope to be here 200 years from now, celebrating our own 200th. Thank you.